Hello, this is Robert Ambrose, KPTZ Board President and host of Rhythm Connection. Like you, I'm waiting to hear Dr. Locke's weekly COVID-19 update. I depend on KPTZ to hear this crucial information because it allows me to better understand how the virus is affecting our community. It also helps me gauge when I might see my distant new grandson. You'd depend on KPTZ to hear Dr. Locke too, and KPTZ depends on you to keep broadcasting. Please consider clicking on the Donate Now button at kptz.org to give us your support for our efforts. Thank you.
KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates held as a virtual meeting during the COVID pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bence will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
Analysis.
So I'm sorry, I was multitasking. So are you leaning in favor or against doing it?
I think so, just given that we need to give people notice.
In favor, Philip, in favor.
Yeah,
okay.
we're maybe just scheduling a half day to be able to do the public health briefing and do a little bit of work, but sure. Not expect a full day of.
Carolyn, how does that impact you?
I'm prepared to do that meeting. I was anticipating it based on a previous conversation a couple months ago.
Okay.
Okay. It is 9:45. So welcome Dr. Locke, Willie Bence, and KPTZ. And just want to make sure you heard that. Well, typically we would not do a fifth Monday meeting on the 29th. Are both of you okay with having our usual Monday morning briefing that day?
Works for me.
Great. Because, you know, in the couple of times that we haven't had a briefing, we have gotten so much grief from the public. So
yeah.
You are the star attractions.
Yeah, they don't miss us. They miss you.
Yes. So welcome. Hope you had a nice weekend and happy to get an update from you this morning.
You're muted, Tom.
I didn't do that. Good morning. We did have a good weekend. We had our first dress rehearsal for the Chimicum mass vaccination event. So Willie and I were there with a bunch of volunteers going through a complete run through of what we are planning to do for real next Sunday. So Sunday, March 21st will be our first sort of volunteer staffed and DEM and public health led mass vaccination event as we ramp up these efforts. In terms of numbers, we continue to see these downward trends nationwide with cases overall down by 19% in the United States. We're now averaging about 55,000 new cases a day in the US, which is still a high number, but dramatically reduced from what it was in early to mid January. The death rate and hospitalization rates continue to go down. And the same trend is occurring in Washington State, although we're leveling off. We've dropped 15% in the last 2 weeks, and we're now just a little under 700 cases a day. New cases is what we're seeing in Washington. And at that, we are ranked 47th among the states. So there's three states with lower activity than us. And two of those are here on the West Coast, are Oregon and California. Things have improved significantly in California in the last couple weeks. There's several concerning things in Washington State. The sort of inevitable spread of the variant forms of coronavirus. We're tracking that. We've now confirmed over 100 cases of the UK variant, and the more we test, the more we'll find. It's certainly on track to fulfill the expectation that probably by the end of this month, it will be the dominant strain in the United States. It's currently about 20% of cases in the US are the UK strain. It's more transmissible, and so it tends to predominate in areas where the virus is spreading. And how fast it takes to become predominant in Washington State is not really known. It could not stretch into April, but eventually that will be the new form of coronavirus, and so it'll be more challenging to control. The other thing that was reported by Dr. Lindquist, the state infectious disease epidemiologist, on Friday, was there seen an uptick in cases in the 20 to 39 year old age group. And that in the past, in past waves, that's been one of the harbingers of increased activity. It starts among the young who tend to sort of have the highest risk behaviors, at least in terms of social interactions, and then can spread into other populations. Although more and more, we're getting those other populations vaccinated. So we're not exactly sure how this will play out. Here in Jefferson County, things are doing really well. And before I give our case rate, I need to make the distinction between confirmed and probable cases. So a confirmed case is considered one where a PCR test, which is sort of the gold standard for testing, is positive. And then a probable case is when the less accurate rapid test is used. So right now, Jefferson County has had no confirmed cases for the last 2 weeks. So wow. Our confirmed case rate is zero. We have had one probable case that we're not really sure if it's a real case or not. In that it was what's called a surveillance culture or a surveillance test. So it was done on someone without symptoms or exposure history. So it might be. And in the roadmap to recovery statistics, these probable cases are actually counted. So on that roadmap metric, we are at 3.1 cases per 100,000 for 2 weeks, which is still a very low rate. So that's what our numbers are. Clallam County is at 37 per 100,000. Kitsap is at 64, and Mason County is at 65. And I might just mention it as we move into this next phase of roadmap to recovery, which will start statewide in about a week from today, the metrics that are going to be used are changing. So we're going to stop using percent positivity. It's proven to be very inaccurate because it a lot of it has to do with how many tests you do and whether the state is able to count the number of negative tests done, which has turned out to be very hard to do. So they're abandoning that metric. And it's all going to be about case rates, so cases per 100,000, and then some statistics related to hospitalization. And there's going to be an unusual demarcation. So if you're in a county of 50,000 and above, it will be a case rate. So if your case rate goes above 200 per 100,000 for 2 weeks, then you have to step back to a earlier stage of recovery, so from 3 to 2. But if you're in a county below 50,000, then it's just based on the absolute number of cases you have. So it would be 30 cases. So if you have 30 cases over 2 weeks, that would be considered an excessive level. And for Jefferson County, that would be about 93 cases per 100,000. But where it gets bizarre is if you if you were in a county that was just shy of 50,000, then you could, the threshold could be 60 cases per 100,000. And if you were in a very small county, like say Wakayakum, I did the math, Wakayakum is just shy of 4,000 people, your case rate would be 750 per 100,000 before you would step back. So we're not too concerned about this. I think actually 30 is a pretty good number for Jefferson County. And around 100 cases per 100,000 is really where we should be if we want to be, you know, safely doing the kind of openings that phase three envisions. So
can I ask you one question on that? Just to be clear, we're in control of our own ship now. It's no more regional approach. They're just going to look at Jefferson County.
Yeah, exactly. So the roadmap regions are out, at least in terms of reopening, as of next week. So we'll be, but we'll be looking at the whole region because that's really where the risk is. And still there's significant risk in the I-5 corridor. Pierce County currently is about 200 cases per 100,000, The King County is over 100. Statewide, we're at about 140 cases per 100,000. And a lot of us are concerned, certainly Dr. Barry in Clallam County and myself are, that statewide levels are still too high, especially with the variants, to be doing some of the things that are envisioned, especially some of the sporting events and high density indoor dining. It's taking a risk. But a lot of it will depend on how people behave in those environments. You know, if they really take maximum precautions or very careful, we might not see adverse effects. It's not guaranteed that this is going to promote spread. Unlike some states, you know, I have to say places like Texas and Mississippi and Florida are pretty much guaranteeing that they're going to have a fourth wave. And they need only look to what's going on in Europe right now to get a preview of what's going to happen, you know, when you have variant infections. And Italy, Germany, France are closing down again. Britain's been closed down for the last several months, and I think they might be able to open at the end of this month. But that's what happens when you abandon precautions prematurely. And unfortunately, we'll see it playing out in the U.S. And then
you just muted again, Dr. Luck.
I'm my computer is censoring me today. It's auto muting. So please tell me if you lose sound. So vaccination numbers. We're really ramping up volumes in the state. We've been staying at 45,000 a day or greater. We've given out or administered almost 2.3 million doses in the state so far. And statewide, that means 19% of state residents have received at least one dose, and about 11% are fully immunized. In Jefferson County, it's even higher. It's much higher. In fact, we may be the highest state county right now in terms of number of first doses given. We're at 35.17% of residents have received at least one dose, and 19.4 are fully immunized. And we're now a little bit above Clallam County. That's we've been kind of neck and neck as leaders in the state. They're at 32% on first dose, but they've surged ahead in terms of fully immunized. So 23.6%, almost a quarter of the county population in Clallam County is now fully immunized. So those are great statistics. And, you know, that's required administering 45,000 doses, you know, one at a time. We're committed in Jefferson County to give the vaccine as fast as we can bring it in. And although as the state moves to a new allocation formula, we may find that our position as state leaders causes us, our allocations to drop a bit for a few weeks as the rest of the state catches up. And that's just yet to be seen. We thought it might happen this week, but it hasn't. The hospital got their full allocation of vaccine, although in this case in Moderna vaccine, and they're transferring a couple hundred doses of their vaccine to the health department so that we'll have enough to do this first clinic next Sunday. And we hope to be able to do those on a weekly basis, as long as supplies ramp up. And then in April, we're expecting the significant amounts of Johnson & Johnson, the one-dose vaccine, will start to become available. And so far, this is proving very popular. People like that kind of one-and-done approach. And I'm glad of that. We want all vaccines to be well-received. So we're not going to get any more J&J vaccine in this state for the rest of this month, but it'll pick up dramatically in April, and then in May and June we should have huge amounts. We'll have over 100 million doses in the U.S. available. So that's the goal, is that we'll be all through these prioritization phases and into just open access by the beginning of May, and we might be able to do it even sooner in Washington State. And in terms of prioritization levels, this week we're moving to the next level. So as of Wednesday, we'll be able to offer vaccination to what are known as critical workers working in congregate settings. So people like grocery workers and law enforcement and courts and jails and first responders who are not eligible under earlier guidelines, and emergency dispatch. All those groups are now eligible, and we're scheduling. So many of them already have their appointments to be vaccinated this week. Also, pregnant women are now on the list, and people with certain disabilities that increase their risk of COVID complications. They're on the new list. So maybe I could pause and ask for any commissioner questions before I move on to our KPTZ listeners who have some really good questions this week.
Just quickly, you really addressed my concerns or questions this morning, but we had a public comment question asking if there's going to be any graduation in age bands within the vaccination delivery, the 50 to 64 age band, are you going to get prioritized if you're closer to 60, and or is it just if you have an underlying condition, or do you have any insight into that?
The state under the in the next tier we go to, so the B3 tier is about people who have these so-called comorbidities, medical conditions that increase the risk of complications. And the current state formula is if the first group is 50 to 64. So people with these medical comorbidities, they go first. I believe it's forecast to be on April 12th. Although I think we're gonna get to it before then. And then on April 26th, it will be 16 to 49. So that group will be broken into two bands. And then after that, I don't think there's going to be
that also with comorbidities.
Pardon?
Is that also with comorbidities?
Yes. The 16 to 49 would be two or more of these conditions off of a list of about 25 conditions that the CDC defines as increasing your risk. So, and then tier four is projected to be in the third or fourth week of April. And then after that, we'll be out of the priority scheme. As an example, one KPTZ listener said, you know, they're 60 years old. When can they expect to be vaccinated? And it comes down to if they, it's going to be May unless they fall into one of these occupational groups. They're a critical worker, or they live in a congregate setting, or they're a volunteer in a congregate setting, or they have medical conditions. But if you're a perfectly healthy 60-year-old who lives in a single family residence and does not have a high risk occupation, it's looking like the very end of April, but certainly in the early part of May, we think things will be kind of wide open. And that's what the president has been urging, and he can do more than urge. He can compel the states to adopt certain priorities.
Great, thank you.
Okay, well,
can you explain why restaurant workers aren't included in the high risk working category?
It's I can't fully explain it. But it was based on exposure risk, and also to some degree the evidence of outbreaks. You know, so fortunately, we have not seen outbreaks in restaurant workers. It's when we see outbreaks and transmissions associated with restaurants, it's between customers. It's when people use restaurants to gather with non-household members. That's where we've seen transmission. So it's the rationale, the medical rationale for the criteria are, it's really a combination of, you know, whether you have increased risk of COVID complications and whether there's increased and uncontrollable risk of transmission. So people in congregate settings who have to work close together, they can't space out, they can't use other mitigations like masking, people in food production plants and occupational settings where a lot of people are together in one room. Those things were given the priorities. This started, actually the CDC group kind of put food workers in the, they put them in the fourth tier, in the lowest tier of priorities. And then they just kind of fell off the list in Washington State. They are currently not on a list, although we would be willing to consider it in cases in unusual cases where there's really people are working in very tight quarters. You know, we might be able to consider them as food production workers in that kind of setting, which is a category in the next tier. But what we really want to do is just kind of get past this whole prioritization scheme and get into the phase where we're not only the vaccine's available to everyone, but we're really trying to make it more convenient, more accessible, and we're really promoting it. I think we're closer than people realize to the what's called the push phase of this. So where we move from right now, we're in what's known as the pull. You know, the demand is much greater than the supply, so people will go to great lengths to get vaccinated. But sometime in April or May, the tide will turn, and we're going to have to really actively promote this and make it a lot easier to get vaccinated. And we're sort of developing plans to do that.
Just as a follow-up, you know, I think with capacity increasing in restaurants in phase three, and then just the counterintuitive, you know, these are the only workers that are exposed to people without masks as a part of their day-to-day job. It is confusing. Another confusion I'm hearing a lot about is, you know, just that and you're uniquely qualified to speak to this, that Jamestown has been able to move through phases much more quickly with their vaccination. And it sounds like they are indeed limiting that to residents or workers in Clallam County. Is that right? And what's kind of your advice? I'm hearing a lot of people saying, should we be going to Clallam? And what are the ethics kind of going across county lines? Should we be waiting our turn in this county, or how do you respond to that?
Well, it was is a sovereign government that the Jamestown tribe has been able to set their own criteria. And as an example, this week, they're dropping the age band to 50 and above. So anyone 50 and above. I don't think the residency requirements are strictly enforced. I know of a number of Jefferson County residents who have been vaccinated in Jamestown. We're asking people to roughly follow county patterns, and that's how the allocations are supposed to be done. In reality, they have not been done that way yet. And I know that the Jamestown clinics, their drive-through clinics, have not filled up. This last Saturday, less people came to the event than they had doses to give. So we're in discussions about should we change the criteria still further, because Jamestown has adopted the philosophy that I think is the best one, and that is this is all about vaccine and arms. It's a numbers game. We want to get all the vaccine we can and deliver it to as many people as we can. So that's really the guiding philosophy. And when you drive a car through the Jamestown Clinic, they try to vaccinate everyone in that automobile. That's their goal, because that's four candidates for the vaccine, or however many are in the car. So I think that's going to be the norm more and more. As a county, we are obligated to follow the state's prioritization guidelines. We literally sign an agreement when we take the vaccine that says we will follow their priorities. So it's less discretionary for us. I had to, just quickly, I'll go through some.
Heidi has a question. Sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry, I was muted. I was like, it's a just follow up to that. Can you reflect a little bit on that line of thinking regards to the pharmacy's deployment of vaccine? Because I've heard other people are getting vaccinated, you know, in the community that are not necessarily strictly in a qualifying category. And so I'm just getting a lot of questions about should I just go? Should I try? And I feel a little bit like,
it's great to go to the pharmacies if you can get an appointment. They've been a significant player. The pharmacies have given 19% of the vaccines in the county, as of today. And they are also bound by the state priorities. Where you see people being vaccinated who don't fall into the priority tiers are these sort of leftover doses, which happens with most of the vaccines. You know, we have these vials of 10 doses that we have to use in 6 hours. And if someone doesn't come in, all vaccinators keep a wait list of people that can be called in on short notice, and anyone can be on the wait list. There's a bit of luck involved in that, but it's perfectly legitimate. And you know, if someone wants to go on a pharmacy wait list, they should do that. And they may score a dose. And once you get your first dose, you're guaranteed a second dose if you're on the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
So there were several questions about sort of what you can do if you're fully vaccinated. One person said, you know, I'm 76 and fully vaccinated, and I'm going to have a niece come live with me. And that's fine under the CDC guidelines, although you would want your niece. So if you're fully vaccinated, you can be with people who are unvaccinated, who are at low risk for complications. But you still want those people to be careful when they're out and about in the community. And then a variation of that asks for a sort of a tougher question, saying, A group of fully vaccinated people want to get together 4 to 8 singers in an empty room and close enough that they could hear each other. And that's kind of pushing the envelope on the CDC guidelines. It's under the CDC guidelines, it's fine for unvaccinated people, vaccinated people, fully vaccinated individuals to be together in small groups and interact without distancing or masking. But as you get into medium or larger groups, or if you start to do increased risk activities like singing, you know, which generates more aerosols, then the risk equation changes. And the CDC doesn't really define what a medium to large group would be, but I would urge people to look at, you know, groups below 30. I'd say anything above 30 is a medium-sized group, and anything above 200 is a large group. But in smaller groups, there is really no zero risk equations. There's always the risks that someone might be carrying the infection and you don't know about it. So there's just ways to lower risk. So if you get together with a small group and are singing, distance matters, whether you're all facing the same direction or facing each other matters, ventilation matters. So there's a lot of things you can do that are safer. And in a fully vaccinated group, the thing we know with greatest certainty is those people in that group have an almost zero risk, a close to zero risk of serious or life-threatening infection. And that's a really important thing. I got a question asking whether these monoclonal antibody therapy was available locally, and it is. What's known as bamlanivimab, which as a tongue twister, people just call it BAM, but the monoclonal antibody BAM is available at Jefferson Healthcare, as is remdesivir, which is an antiviral medication. And one of the most useful medications is prednisone, which we now routinely give to people who are developing breathing problems. These are all available and are used locally. There was a question asking when the vaccines are gonna go from emergency use authorization to full FDA approval, and citing that some people are reluctant to get a vaccine that's not fully approved. And we don't know for certain. Pfizer has announced that they're going to submit a application for that sometime in the first quarter of 2021, with the expectation they'll get full approval in the second quarter of 2021. And beyond that, the manufacturers have not said. What it takes to get full approval is you have to apply to the FDA and you have to submit a lot of evidence and information that says your vaccine's safe and effective. Given how fast we've deployed these, these are vaccines that were given to 12 to 15,000 people in their clinical trials. Now they've been given to, 30 million plus people. So I'm sure they have the data to apply once they choose to. And I think that's kind of it. I think we answered the others as part of the other question. So I want to save some time for Willie here.
Great. Welcome, Willie.
Hey, thank you, Commissioner. So as Dr. Locke said, we're prepping for our first joint DEM and public health community mass vaccination clinic this Sunday in Chimicum. That'll be open from about 8 in the morning till 11 or so for our morning shift, and then we'll have a shift in the afternoon around noon 30 to 3 or 4. And we'll be delivering, as you said, 300 doses of Moderna. Appointments for that will likely open tomorrow, so do stay tuned to the county Facebook page, the public health webpage, as well as, you know, other social media sources and things like that, as well as you can call into our call center here at the EOC, one more time, 360-344-9791 to schedule your appointment. The clinic will be appointment-based. It will not be first come, first served, although appointments will be for everyone eligible under the current tiered priority list, so anyone 65 or up, anyone in those new groups in the certain high-risk congregate settings. So if you have questions about whether or not you're in one of those groups, again, check out the public health webpage, the Jeffco EOC webpage, and you can take a look for that guidance to find out. If you have any additional questions, again, you can call our hotline to talk to one of our volunteers, figure it out, and grab an appointment from there. So we will have those 300 slots. Of course, we're planning on scheduling one this weekend. We are going to be finding out every week whether or not we're going to be getting more doses of vaccine in addition to what Jefferson Healthcare is getting. So whether or not there's one the following week, and we're making an announcement on a week-to-week basis. Of course, the hope that things start to stabilize a little bit, although there's still some uncertainty around the state's new allocation guidelines. The single question for me from KPTZ this week had to do with, again, some of the things that we can have volunteers do in the clinic, specifically on the medical side. This will be a primarily volunteer-led clinic. I'd estimate that 90-plus percent of the staff on site will be community volunteers. So this is really going to be the Jefferson County community stepping up to help make this happen. So we're thankful for everyone who's reached out thus far. But of course, as I've said before in these meetings, you know, long term, this is going to be a really heavy lift, so we can really use all the help that we can get. On the medical side, to actually put shots into arms, you do need to have a license in Washington State. Now, license can be either active or inactive, thankfully. So for those retired medical professionals, your license doesn't have to be currently active for you to be able to actually deliver vaccine. If your license is from out of state, unfortunately, that precludes you from being able to actually directly vaccinate people. But there are still a lot of opportunities for you and a lot of opportunities for us to leverage your medical experience. We have folks who are greeting people at the door, and then folks who are screening patients as they come in, asking them some kind of core questions about, if they've had previous, core experiences getting vaccinated, if they have any underlying health issues, things like that. Then, of course, after folks receive the vaccine, we do need to monitor people for 15 minutes for any adverse reactions, where having medical experience is very valuable, and we don't actually have to have you have that in-state license to be able to perform these positions. Even just having previous medical experience and knowledge would be useful, so you can engage with folks, answer some of their questions, et cetera. And then again, especially on the monitoring front, being able to appropriately recognize when someone is having an adverse reaction, flag them for some more additional assistance, will be very useful. So, you know, whether your license is active or inactive, in state or out of state, we can use you and use your medical expertise. You just may not be able to actually deliver a shot directly into someone's arm. If you don't have any medical experience, there's still a ton of work to be done, especially in terms of logistics and traffic control. Again, we're planning on running 300 people through this initial clinic, but our eventual goal is, once we start doing second doses, we want to do 600 a day. And so there's going to be a lot of folks moving through, a lot of cars moving through, and we need help in directing people. If people need assistance, and you need some, they have mobility needs and they need a hand getting into the facility, we need folks to help with that. So there's a lot of work, a lot of small tasks, a lot of things you don't need any expertise in the medical field to be able to help out in. If you do want to participate and volunteer in one of our clinics, contact us at DEM. Our email is jcdem@co.jefferson.wa.us. And depending on what your role is going to be, there's going to be a couple of, you know, some paperwork for you to fill out and some hoops for you to jump through, especially if you're on the medical side and you're going to be vaccinating anyone. Obviously, the training burden and the paperwork burden is going to be a little bit greater for you than someone who's directing traffic. So bear with us. If we don't get back to you right away, well, we're trying to get back to everyone within 48 hours or so, but we have a lot of volunteers stepping forward, and we're a small staff here trying to coordinate everyone as quickly as possible. So reach out to us and we'll get back to you as quickly as we can on your next steps. Other than that, we are starting scheduling with our existing volunteers for this weekend's clinic. We have about 100 folks. We already have, their paperwork completed, training completed, et cetera, who we're ready to tap into for this weekend. So we're probably not going to be able to put new volunteers to work this weekend. But again, this is going to be a really long, difficult process. It's going to be a lot of hard work to run these clinics on a regular basis. And I should mention as well that we are still supporting the Jefferson Healthcare Clinic with volunteers as well, typically with over 100 volunteer shifts available every week. So again, the need is there. We have a lot of great volunteers stepping forward thus far, but I do worry about them getting tired. So anyone who's still ready and still willing, please reach out and we'll put you to work. That's mostly it from me, and I touched on my one KPTZ question. So anything else, Philip?
Yeah, just a comment. I mentioned at the beginning of this meeting that I got vaccinated up at Jefferson Healthcare this weekend, and I was really impressed by how well coordinated and organized it was and how many DEM community volunteers were there making it all happen in terms of just traffic flow. So really well done. And how many days a week are they operating? Is it 6 days?
Yeah, they're now up to 6 days a week and doing about 300 to 350 doses a day. Yeah.
So that's a lot of volunteers, a lot of volunteer hours and shifts over the course of a week. So just hats off to you. And then to be doing these mass clinics on top of that, that's pretty huge. So you're the little engine that could.
And I do have to say, and I'll get to you, Commissioner Eisenhower, I do have to say that Jefferson Healthcare is doing a phenomenal job operating that clinic, and we're happy to help augment their staffing with some of our volunteers. But in the way they've refined a lot of their processes and they've been putting their shoulder to the wheel, they're still operating a hospital and providing medical services full time on top of this clinic. So they're doing a phenomenal job, and we're honored and happy to be able to support them with some volunteers and hopefully give their staff a little bit of a break and make it run that much smoother. So yeah, Commissioner.
I was just gonna further say that I have a friend who volunteered, and it, in addition to it being a great thing for the folks getting the vaccine, it's actually a great thing for the people volunteering. They feel really great about helping in this way and being part of the solution in our community. And I just wanted to commend you, Willie, for your recruitment and engaging of people in our community and serving our community in this way, because it's meaningful on all fronts from all perspectives. And I've already, on a second thing, I've already gotten the question since we talked about it about 12 minutes ago. How do I get on the wait list? How do I get on a wait list? Actually, I would like to know how I get on a wait list, but someone asked me that.
Are you asking about volunteering?
Can you not hear me?
Which wait list are you talking about?
Wait list for the vaccine. Sorry. We were talking about that earlier and someone already texted me. How do I get on a wait list?
Before you answer that, can we clarify who is eligible for the mass vaccine clinic on March 21st? It would be really helpful to have that very clearly stated.
Yes. So on the mass community vaccination event on the 21st, it will be anyone eligible under the state's current open tiering system. So there will be no sub tiering based on what, unlike the 65 plus age bands, where first we did, 85 plus and then 80, anyone who's eligible at the state level will be eligible for this mass community vaccination event. It includes anyone who's 65 or up. It includes Folks who are 50 years or older in multi-generational households, and they've been eligible for quite a while. It includes any educational staff as well as childcare providers, so teachers, et cetera. And then the latest group to be eligible are those workers in the high-risk congregate work settings. So that includes folks, and I'm sorry, I have to look at my poster to the side to read off of this. It includes folks in the agriculture industry, fishing vessel crews, grocery stores, corrections staff, public transit, remaining first responders not vaccinated under the 1A tier list. And then finally, this new tier eligibility also includes folks who are 16 years or older, who have who are pregnant or have a disability that puts them at a high risk for COVID-19. And those folks are primarily being identified by healthcare providers. But we're going to be open to, again, any one of those groups that's open under the state's current tiering system. And I'll let Dr. Locke modify that if need be.
No, I think that's a great rundown. And the best way for people to determine whether they're eligible is to go to the Department of Health Phase Finder site, if you have a computer, and it'll ask you a series of questions. And at the end of those questions, it will tell you. And in fact, you can even print out a certificate saying that you're eligible. And that's what we're asking people to do. When you call for appointments, we'll ask you to verify through Phase Finder that you're eligible. So it helps coach people through the nuance of this. And then in terms of wait list, if what you're referring to is this the extra dose wait list, that kind of varies by each pharmacy how they handle it. So unfortunately, there's no central registry for extra doses. It's just a kind of contingency plan for vaccinators. If at the end of a shift you find that you've got open vials that and no one to give them to, then you have to start making some frantic calls to get it used. We've been very successful at just, very close to zero wastage. We use every dose we have, but it sometimes takes a little scrambling at the end of the day.
Okay.
And you can use...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I want to add one more thing, and you can use that Phase Finder application. So if you're not eligible currently, then you can enter your email and a phone number, and that will then notify you when you are eligible as well. So I think that's also a wait list folks are asking for is, I'm not 65 plus, I'm not currently working and don't fall into one of these, currently open categories. I want to know when it's going to be my turn. You can go on Phase Finder, verify that, hey, it might not be your turn quite yet, but then you can enter in your contact information and then get that notification when your time has indeed come. And then you can schedule an appointment locally and go from there.
Great. Just real quick, the high-risk congregate workers, is that 50 plus or anyone working in those categories?
Anyone. They thankfully removed that the age band for the high-risk congregate setting workers. And so any age working in one of those settings can get vaccinated.
Great. Thank you. We do have our guests from DNR joining us. Any last questions for Dr. Locke or Willie? Greg, you're uncharacteristically quiet.
They've answered all my questions. I don't know. I will give, while we have the radio audience with us still, just a quick shout out to Danny Barnes, robbed last night at the Grammys, Jefferson County resident, nominated for a Grammy. And, we might have lost the Bluegrass Award, but it is still bluegrass that my daughter will deal with and endure. So go Danny Barnes.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Locke and Willie. We'll see you next week. Great. All right. Everybody fine if we roll right into our report with DNR?
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.
And I'll just repeat that this is KPTZ Fort Townsend, and the recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. So if you missed it, tune it in, tune in then, it'll be there.